Hello, listeners. This is Carolyn Yeager, bringing you the fifth installment of my reading of the Wehrmacht War Crimes Bureau, 1939 to 1945, a book written by Alfred de Zayas from the surviving files of this bureau. Today I will read chapters 9 and 10. Chapter 9 is titled The Bureau and War Crimes Trials. It's 14 and a half pages long. Besides supporting diplomatic notes and filling the pages of official white papers, the documentation collected by the War Crimes Bureau was used in preparing war crimes trials against Polish, French, Russian, Yugoslavian, and other Allied prisoners of war. The first step towards a trial on such charges was to determine whether a suspect mentioned in a deposition was being held as a prisoner of war under German jurisdiction. In cooperation with the Armed Forces Central Bureau for Casualties and Prisoners of War, the War Crimes Bureau located many suspects and frequently also further witnesses. It then forwarded the pertinent documents to the appropriate military court with a recommendation for court-martial. At the commencement of a judicial hearing against a prisoner of war, it was the obligation of the detaining powers foreign office, pursuant to Article 60 of the Geneva Convention of 1929, to notify the protecting power. Upon the completion of judicial proceedings, a transcript of the judgment was forwarded, as a matter of course, to the Bureau as Central Documentation Center. The next section is headed The Question of Jurisdiction. There is no doubt whatever that a detaining power may try a prisoner of war for offenses committed during internment. At the outbreak of World War II, it was not entirely clear, however, whether a prisoner of war was subject to the military courts of the detaining power for offenses committed before his capture. Many World War I POWs had been punished for such post-capture offenses as breach of discipline, attempted escape, striking a guard, and the like, but there was little experience in the field of prosecuting war crimes. The prevalent view held that there was no personal liability of the soldier. Indeed, Article 3 of the Fourth Hague Convention of 1907 made a belligerent party, quote, responsible for all acts committed by persons forming part of its armed forces, unquote. According to this provision, the injured state could claim reparation or compensation from the home state of the person committing the violation of international law, but was the injured state precluded from prosecuting the offender if he became a prisoner of war? Neither the 1907 Hague regulations on land warfare, nor the 1929 Geneva Convention relative to the treatment of prisoners of war, answered this question. The penal sanctions set forth in Articles 45 to 67 of the Geneva Convention appear to apply primarily to offenses committed during internment. It said, quote, prisoners of war shall be subject to the laws, regulations, and orders in force in the armed forces of the detaining power, unquote. What this article failed to specify was whether submission to those laws applied retroactively. National manuals on military law were more specific. For example, Article 59 of the American Instructions provide that a prisoner of war remains answerable for his crimes committed against the captor's army or people before he was captured and for which he has not been punished by his own authorities. The British manual provides that, quote, a prisoner of war who committed an offense against the customs of war, such, for example, as stabbing or robbing wounded men, may be considered to have forfeited the character of a prisoner of war and be punished with death for his crime, unquote. The German Kriegsgebrauch im Landkriege lists specific rules of international law and then adds that, quote, whoever breaks these rules shall be prosecuted by his state. If he is taken prisoner, he is subject to punishment by foreign court-martial, unquote. The legal experts in the Ausland Abwehr Bureau of the Wehrmacht High Command challenged the view set forth in the American and British manuals and stated in a memorandum dated 30th December 1940 respecting a previously concluding trial, quote, "A sentence has been passed on a prisoner of war because of an offense that he may have committed before he became a prisoner. This is fundamentally wrong. The sole purpose of imprisonment is to prevent an enemy soldier from further actions. It is not admissible to international law to equate imprisonment as a prisoner of war with other cases in which a person falls within the jurisdiction of another state, whether by entering the territory of the other state or by extradition from another state. In the first case, existing criminal charges may be pressed without limitation. In the second case, only to the extent agreed to by the extraditing state. The prosecution of a prisoner of war because of offenses which he committed against the detaining power before his imprisonment would equate imprisonment with an extradition without conditions. This violates both general principles of international law and also the soldier's code of honor. Since the function of military courts with respect to foreigners consists solely in carrying out with due process such necessary military measures as further the war effort, the execution of the death sentence against a prisoner of war for offenses committed before imprisonment must be considered as killing a defenseless enemy and therefore violates the Hague regulations on land warfare. For the violation of those regulations, only the state is liable in international law, and there is no individual criminal responsibility. Pursuant to this view, the individual can be criminally punished by an enemy state only when his home state refuses to assume the responsibility or does not cover the soldier's act and consents to his punishment by the enemy state. Obviously, this can occur only in cases of gross violations of the laws of war, which display a dishonorable attitude that damages the reputation of his army. Only in such cases can war crimes trials be conducted without disadvantageous political and propagandistic consequences. That's the end of that quote. This position did not prevail, partly because it was not shared by the Allies. Yet, interestingly enough, it seems that during the war, Germans refrained from trying British and American prisoners on war crimes charges, and neither Great Britain nor the United States tried any German prisoners for war crimes prior to the German unconditional surrender. Evidently, neither side wanted to give the other a reason to retaliate. Germany did not hesitate to try prisoners of war of other nationalities, however. This section is headed Trials of Polish Prisoners of War. During and after the German invasion of Poland, the Bureau carried out extensive investigations of war crimes allegedly committed by Polish soldiers and civilians against German soldiers and the German ethnic minority in Poland, and numerous trials followed. No protecting power was ever notified of these proceedings. According to Judge Walter Lichtenheldt, who was responsible for the prisoner of war department in the Wehrmacht's legal division, the Geneva Convention of 1929, quote, had no application with regard to Polish prisoners of war because Poland had ceased to exist, unquote. A major problem for the investigators was that witness testimony rarely named the perpetrators. It dealt chiefly with events, victims, and survivors. Only after a great many Polish civilians and prisoners of war had been questioned could the Bureau arrive at the names of some of the suspects. Even then, the majority of criminal proceedings had to be discontinued, either because the suspect was not a prisoner of war or was, quote, clearly not the culprit, unquote. And in parentheses, he writes, some discontinued proceedings were later reopened in the light of new evidence, however. When the investigations did lead to trials, they were held before special courts in Polish cities. One such case involved Sergeant Lucius Korzynski, who, according to witness testimony, killed two German prisoners of war shortly before German troops marched into the town of Grodzisk in September 1939. The special court in Lodz sentenced him to death on 28 November 1939 because he had known, quote, that according to the laws of war, he had only the choice to evacuate both prisoners or to let them go free. He also knew that even his superior could not order him to kill the two prisoners, since prisoners of war and military internees, as the accused knew, would not be killed even pursuant to Polish law, except if sentenced by a court, and no sentence had been passed against the two prisoners, unquote. Similar trials were still taking place several years later. Captain Sigmund Rakosi was sentenced on 6 March 1942 and executed in April for having ordered the killing of German prisoners in September 1939. Another suspect, Private Jan Lysiak, could not be found. Private Andreas Filarski was acquitted. In parentheses, Filarski had allegedly held up a prisoner who did not want to stand up so that he could be shot. Another mid-war trial ended on 15 January 1943 when a Captain Lessig, accused of having ordered the execution of 7 German prisoners of war, committed suicide. The following case illustrates the bureaucratic and unspectacular methods used in these criminal investigations. A Polish lieutenant had testified against his comrade Zmudzinski, claiming that he had killed a German prisoner of war named Rode, who had resided in Dusseldorf, worked as a locksmith, and been married to a woman called Martha. An investigation carried out by the Dusseldorf Police Department failed to confirm the residence of the locksmith Rode, since no other evidence existed against Zmudzinski. The special court in Warsaw dismissed the proceedings on 10 November, 1941. Well, just an aside by me, that shows that they did investigate everything, even against their enemies, and that they were concerned about justice for everyone, I think. So, continuing on, the trial with the largest number of accused was that of Captain Jan Zerwicki and 37 others. Zerwicki had led a special troop of Polish reserves assigned to evacuate a number of ethnic Germans from the western zones of Poland. Now we're talking about ethnic Germans living there, not soldiers. The forced march began in Torun on 3rd September 1939 and lasted for 11 days, at the end of which some 230 Germans had lost their lives. The trial before a special court in Bromberg ended on 1st April 1942, 3 years later, a little less than that. 21 of the Polish prisoners of war were condemned to death. One was sentenced to 5 years imprisonment. 16 were acquitted. The rationale of the court was laid down in a judgment of 177 pages. In view of the fact that no suspects could be found for most of the specified crimes, some fanatical Nazi Party members, particularly functionaries of the occupation government, started thinking in terms of reprisals. When the criminal investigation of the murder of a married couple by the name of Nickel, that would have been a German couple, probably Polish citizens, When the investigation of their murder had dragged on for 4 years but yielded no suspects, the frustrated prosecutor proposed to the high command of the Wehrmacht that collective penalties be imposed on all Polish soldiers who had been in the area of the crime. The legal department rejected the proposal on 19 February 1944. Referring to the express prohibition of collective penalties in the Geneva Convention of 1929. The Prisoner of War Department also disapproved. They said, a reprisal might have been appropriate if carried out by the fighting troop immediately after discovery of the crime, but a collective penalty is out of the question after more than 4 years have elapsed. Unquote. According to an incomplete list of judicial proceedings against Polish prisoners of war, it appears that at least 252 cases were investigated, of which some two-thirds ended in dismissal. Death sentences were passed on at least 28 persons. At least 21 were acquitted. Well, that's not a very high number of death sentences. 28. The next section is titled Trials of French Prisoners of War. In the months of May and June 1940, during the fighting between Germany and France, German military courts initiated proceedings against French soldiers for alleged violations of the laws of war and against French civilians for fighting as irregular combatants, or franc-tireurs. One well-known case involved the killing of the crew of a Henkel 111 that crash-landed near Vimy in northern France. The court-martial met in Doullens under Judge Albert Lochner. The trial of three French civilians on June 6, 1940, ended with the death sentence against all three. The sentence was carried out on 29 June 1940 in Doullens. In another case, four German airmen were severely manhandled by 40 to 50 armed farmers and gendarmes after they crash-landed in a field. The court of the German 5th Armored Division passed the death sentence on two of the farmers in Brest on 23 June 1940. Three others were acquitted because of insufficient evidence. After the armistice with France on 22 June 1940, the prosecution of other suspected war criminals was a subject of some controversy. On 25 August 1940, the High Command of the Luftwaffe proposed that French courts try their own soldiers. The German Armistice Commission, however, responded on 29 August that it would be inopportune to burden the French delegation with such matters, better to postpone the question until the war was over and a peace treaty could be drawn up. The legal department of the Wehrmacht pleaded for the prompt commencement of criminal proceedings, but the armistice agreement made no provision for such proceedings. A proposal that French authorities deliver French suspects for trial by German courts not only promised an undue burden on the German side, but recalled uneasy memories of the Reich's post-World War I resistance to the demand of the victors that Germans be delivered for trial before French courts. Finally, the German Armistice Commission proposed that only the gravest cases be investigated and then, given sufficient evidence, prosecution be demanded of the French government. Rudolf Lehmann commented on this proposal extensively in a memorandum to Ausland Abwehr on 2 September 1940. Remember, Rudolf Lehmann is one of the judges of the Wehrmacht War Crimes Bureau. He wrote, French soldiers and civilians frequently offended, robbed, and mistreated German prisoners of war. Soldiers and civilians. Thus far, they have hardly been called to answer for their conduct. Pursuant to the Reich Criminal Code, these offenses may be prosecuted according to German law. Although the victims generally cannot identify the perpetrators, we know from the experience of the courts with the Polish murders that a number of the perpetrators will be convicted. We should consider whether extradition should be demanded. The decision is solely political, but the legal department of the Wehrmacht would submit the following points of view for deliberation. An objection to the demand for extradition is that it would be a repeat performance of the demand that France made of Germany in 1919. We succeeded then in persuading France that it would be advisable to refrain from actually extraditing the accused. Now we would have to face the same arguments on the French side, which we ourselves pressed against extradition. Thus, we should leave the trial to the perpetrators, in the hands of French justice. By doing this, we would avoid the accusations which foreign countries would certainly raise with respect to unfair and harsh justice, and at the same time, France would have to try her own citizens for war crimes, and thereby admit that Frenchmen have gravely violated the laws of war. We have an opportunity to discuss these matters with the French within the Armistice Commission. The legal department of the Wehrmacht requests to be kept informed of the outcome of discussions at the Foreign Office so as to continue taking its part in further preparatory work. Unquote. At a meeting of the Armistice Commission in Wiesbaden on 25 September 1940, Maximilian Wagner and Alphonse Waltzog elaborated further. They wrote, quote, "There is an enormous body of incriminatory evidence. It is essential to bring these offenders to justice in all serious cases. The question of jurisdiction may be answered as follows. Perpetrators in German prisoner of war camps or in occupied French territory can be brought before German military courts. Perpetrators in the unoccupied part of France shall be dealt with by the French courts. The main difficulty consists in finding the perpetrators. Even when it is known who committed the crime, a time-consuming investigation must be carried out to discover his whereabouts so as to determine whether jurisdiction lies with the German court." Unquote. You can see the problem is that there's way too much to do and not enough personnel, so then they have to decide what is most important, what they give up in order to do something else. On 26 November 1940, Lehman proposed that a Foreign Office approach the Armistice Commission to expedite the process of commencing war crimes trials before French courts and under German supervision. Out of political considerations, however, the Foreign Office declined to pursue the matter. In the meantime, the Bureau had produced its first massive documentation on alleged French violations of international law. Upon receipt of the second volume, the Foreign Office reacted on 8 May 1941 with a clear indication that no demand would be made of the French government to prosecute its own citizens until the Foreign Office saw fit. A similar communication was sent on 10 May 1941 to the Wehrmacht High Command. After numerous consultations between Lehman and Foreign Office Counselor Rüdiger, the legal department of the Wehrmacht agreed to observe the wishes of the Foreign Office in order to help improve relations with the French government. Lehman even ordered a stay of execution of all death sentences in occupied France. Wow, that's going too far, I'd say. Nevertheless, the Bureau had continued to collect and prepare the evidence for war crimes trials. Wagner informed the Foreign Office on 23 May 1941 that a number of significant cases were ready for submission to French authorities, but on 8 June, the Foreign Office again expressed its reservations. Quote, "For the time being, it does not seem advisable to approach the French government with respect to the prosecution of French war criminals in unoccupied territory by French courts. The Foreign Office may review this matter at the appropriate time and rely on the above-mentioned note." Unquote. In fact, the Foreign Office routinely reconsidered the matter every 3 months. Not until the Germans and Italians invaded the rest of France in December 1942, however, did the Foreign Office again turn to the legal department of the Wehrmacht. On 23 January 1943, Rüdiger wrote to ask Lehman, quote, "whether the Wehrmacht had taken or was planning to take measures with respect to a criminal prosecution of French war criminals in the previously unoccupied part of France." Unquote. And apparently the question was again discussed in February 1943, but no criminal proceedings seemed to have been undertaken at that time. Still, in the northern part of France that had been occupied since June 1940, German military courts did routinely prosecute the cases that came to their attention, although with the passing of time, they tended to render milder judgments than those passed in Vimy and Brest. On 29 April 1941, the military court in Paris tried 10 French civilians who on 10th May 1940 had mistreated and robbed the crew of a Henkel 111 that had crash-landed nearby. Two of the accused were acquitted. Eight were convicted of assault rather than treated as franc tireurs, that is, partisans. The highest sentence was 3 years imprisonment, and three of the convicted were released immediately, their imprisonment awaiting trial being counted against the sentence. The trial of Lieutenant Jules Levresse had greater political impact than routine trials against alleged franc tireurs or partisans, since the accused was a French officer from a prominent family. He was charged with violating Article 7 of the 1929 Geneva Convention, which provides that as soon as possible, after the capture, prisoners of war shall be evacuated to depots sufficiently removed from the fighting zone to put them out of danger. Apparently, Levresse had failed to evacuate a number of German prisoners and had thereby exposed them to the danger of German artillery fire. According to the testimony of the survivors, a number of them were wounded and two died. In this case, the Foreign Office sent proper notification of the trial to the United States as protecting power, as provided in Article 60 of the 1929 Geneva Convention. On 27 October 1940, the German military court of the 269th Division convicted Levresse of multiple murder under Article 211 of the German Penal Code and condemned him to death. In November, the sentence was confirmed by an Army High Command and, pursuant to the German Ordinance on Criminal Procedure, had next to be submitted to Hitler as Commander-in-Chief of the Wehrmacht. In a memorandum dated 30 December 1940, the Ausland Abwehr objected to the death sentence, and on 30 January 1941, it appealed to the legal department of the Wehrmacht to support a petition for clemency. Well, there you go. One department has political considerations in mind and obstructs another department that's doing its job properly. Meanwhile, the French government had taken up the matter, and on 28 January 1941, Marshal Philippe Pétain directed his defense minister, General Charles Hunzinger, to appeal to the German military authorities. Quote, "As father of my people and of my soldiers, I cannot be indifferent to the fate of an officer whose record of service and excellent leadership prove his high moral character, oh sure, and when his soldierly honor cannot be questioned. I am also concerned about the grief of a young wife who, as a model of brave womanhood, awaits in anguish the execution of the sentence against her husband." Unquote. In conveying this appeal to Field Marshal Wilhelm Keitel as head of the Wehrmacht High Command on 30th January 1941, Hunzinger asserted that it was far from his intention, quote, "to question the high sense of duty of the members of the competent military court," unquote. Yet in view of the respect that Levresse enjoyed among both his superiors and his comrades, and because the combat situation was so confused, the sentence should be reduced. Keitel then submitted the case to Hitler, who took his time in making a decision. Not until 24 May 1941 did he order the sentence changed from death to imprisonment. On 29 May 1941, Rudolf Lehmann noted that political considerations had determined the outcome. Lavresse was taken to Bockenheim Prison in Frankfurt am Main. On 23 February 1943, he was transferred to the hard labor prison at Bruxelles, and on 3 August 1944 to the Wehrmacht prison in Munich. He was repatriated to France on 16 May 1945. The next section is headed Criminal Investigations of British and American Prisoners of War. In June of 1941, upon the conclusion of the campaign in Crete, the German press announced that special courts had been set up in Crete to try British and Cretan prisoners of war for atrocities committed on German parachutists. Since the United States was then acting as protecting power for Great Britain, the American Embassy in Berlin reported this development to the State Department in Washington, which in turn informed the British Foreign Office on 10 June 1941, adding that, quote, certain punitive measures, at least with respect to the Cretans, appeared to be necessary for the morale of the parachute troops, unquote. On 5 August 1941, a German military tribunal in Crete convicted John Zazaronakis of Franc-Tireur, or partisan, activities, and of plundering the bodies of dead soldiers. The court sentenced Zazaronakis to death because, quote, the situation in Crete and the security of German soldiers on the island required drastic measures for the sake of deterrence, and by the same token it is imperative to carry out the sentence as soon as possible, unquote. The execution took place the same day. The government of the United States, as protecting power, did not learn officially or unofficially of any trials actually carried out against British prisoners of war, however. It may be assumed that none took place, since on 2 October 1941, the American Embassy in Berlin reported that the press campaign against British prisoners of war had subsided and that war crimes trials were unlikely. During 1942-43, when Germany had declared war on the United States and the Swiss government was assuming the role of protecting power for both Great Britain and the United States, the German government gave no indication that it planned war crimes trials against British or American prisoners of war. This situation changed following 16 December 1943, when the Soviet Union inaugurated the first war crimes trial against members of the German armed forces at Kharkov. Three German prisoners of war who had been captured at Stalingrad were accused of having murdered Soviet citizens in specially constructed gas vans. Boy, here we go. Captain Wilhelm Langheld, Corporal Reinhard Retzlaw, and Lieutenant Hans Ritz were convicted of atrocities upon the Soviet people and hanged on 19 December 1943. Numerous British and American journalists attended the proceedings and the execution. It is interesting to note that Hitler reacted the same day. During a military conference at the Wolf's Lair, or Wolfschanze, in East Prussia, he, quote, expressed his intention to respond to the sham trial at Kharkov by instituting similar proceedings against British or American officers who have committed violations against international law and ordered the compilation of relevant materials, unquote. The Navy High Command, following Hitler's directive, asked Ausland Abwehr, and remember, Ausland Abwehr is the German military intelligence under Wilhelm Canaris at that time, and the War Crimes Bureau, to furnish the necessary documents, and the Bureau promptly forwarded two memoranda, quote, violations of the laws of war by the British Army, unquote, and, quote, violations of international law by the British armed forces and by civilians on Crete, unquote, and documents relating to low-level air attacks on German civilians. The German Foreign Office issued the official pronouncement at a press conference on 22nd December 1943. It said, "The German military courts will shortly deal with American and British prisoners of war against whom serious war crimes are charged and who have not yet been tried." Unquote. German newspapers and radio elaborated further, announcing that British and American pilots who had bombarded non-military objectives and who had machine-gunned civilians in low-level flights would be put in the dock. Reacting to German reports, the Swiss Neue Zürcher Zeitung newspaper commented on 24 December 1943, quote, "The German threat of taking a reprisal for the trial at Kharkov by punishing British and American flyers who are prisoners of war in Germany has given rise to much concern in American official circles, although some observers believe that the primary purpose of the German announcement was to split the Allied camp." Unquote. The British Foreign Office took the matter with equanimity, manifesting a wait-and-see attitude. On 11 January 1944, it telegraphed the British Embassy in Washington, quote, "We have been considering whether any public statement could usefully be issued, but have reached the conclusion that, short of expressly abandoning our right to try German war criminals, there is nothing we could say that would not involve the danger of driving the Germans, who appear to be still hesitating, into a position from which they might find it difficult to withdraw. In reaching this conclusion, we have been influenced by the fact that under the Geneva Convention we cannot object to trials in Germany provided they are properly conducted." Unquote. 2.5 months later, the press secretary of the German Foreign Office repeated that preparations for the trials were in progress, yet no such trials were ever held. Apparently, the evidence collected by the Bureau did not suffice to establish the guilt of individual prisoners of war. There were enough witnesses who could testify to the shooting of shipwrecked German sailors or the machine gunning of farmers in the field by low-flying Allied planes, but the crimes were anonymous. None of the members of the Royal Navy and Air Force or the American pilots in German prisoner of war camps could be identified as having been personally involved. Other considerations may also explain the failure of German courts to prosecute American and British prisoners of war. Joachim Rudolphi, head of the legal department of the German Navy, surmises that Admiral Karl Dönitz did not like the idea of prosecuting members of the Allied navies and put a damper on Hitler's proposed retaliation. Moreover, Hitler's own interest appears to have subsided. Quote, "Although I was never called in to confer with Hitler, I know from others that in the first burst of anger he often had the idea of taking immediate reprisals, but frequently nothing happened at all because he never came back to it again." Unquote. In the course of the war, a number of British and American prisoners were in fact put on trial, and death sentences were carried out in a handful of cases. But these trials involved not war crimes, but rather offenses committed in prisoner of war camps, such as insurrection or attacks on camp personnel. During the last months of the war, a number of British and American pilots who had been shot down over Germany were lynched by civilian mobs. Most, however, were taken prisoner by local police and treated as prisoners of war. The next section is headed Trials of Russian Prisoners of War. The first part of the Barbarossa jurisdiction order issued by Field Marshal Keitel on 13 May 1941, the, quote, "Decree on Exercising Military Jurisdiction in the Area of Barbarossa and the Special Measures by the Troops," well, that's the title, provided that the military courts and the courts-martial were not competent for crimes committed by enemy civilians. Franc-tireur, or I would rather say partisans, were to be liquidated ruthlessly by the troops in combat or while fleeing, though commanders-in-chief of the army groups could, by agreement with the competent commanders of the Air Force and the Navy, reinstate jurisdiction of the Wehrmacht courts for civilians in areas sufficiently pacified. Pursuant to this order, countless Russian civilians and persons only suspected of partisan activities were summarily shot by the troops or passed on to the SD for execution. Yet it appears that military courts did function in a number of cases and actually afforded the accused a fair trial. Many were acquitted. Where the military courts functioned, a modicum of due process was observed, and the War Crimes Bureau received reports of the judicial investigations. For instance, on 23rd September 1942, the witness Martin Ness testified, "In the course of the search for the two missing soldiers, we discovered that they had been murdered by Russians. We identified two Russian civilians as the perpetrators. They were tried by a German court-martial and were executed by five men in our battalion. Before the two Russians were executed, our battalion commander had them point out the graves of the murdered Germans. The bodies were exhumed, and we could see that they had been mutilated. The eyes had been put out, the tongues had been cut off, and one of them was missing a finger. I myself saw the mutilations." As in the other theaters of war, war crimes committed by regular troops were within the jurisdiction of the German military courts. Trials took place, as a matter of course, without press coverage or the propagandistic trimmings of the Kharkov trial. A German court-martial met, for instance, on 4th December 1943 in Zaporozhye and tried four Russian soldiers on charges of having killed a German prisoner of war and mutilating the body. They were sentenced and executed on 6th December 1943. In another case, the German court in Orsha passed the death sentence on a Russian army surgeon, Nikolai Amaral, who had shot his German patient after receiving an order from his commissar, as testified by two Russian witnesses, prisoners of war, Klucharsky and Sagalaju. But relatively few trials could be held in the field shortly after the crime. Though many killings of German prisoners by their Russian captors were discovered, the witnesses could very seldom give the names of the perpetrators, most of whom in any case were not in German captivity. Sometimes, however, the Bureau did succeed in locating the suspects with the assistance of the Wehrmacht Personnel Department. Usually a fairly long time elapsed between the beginning of the investigation and conviction of the culprit. For instance, two Russian prisoners of war, Lieutenants Pavel Jegorenko and Andrzej Melnikov, testified on 5th December 1941 at the officers' POW camp in Pogegen that they had seen Captain Ivan Ogorodnikov shoot seven defenseless German prisoners of war on the island Ussel. Not until 12 December 1942 could the Bureau discover that Captain Ogorodnikov was in POW Camp 350 in Riga. On 17 September, the Bureau recommended a court-martial. Before it was called, the witnesses Jegorenko and Melnikov again gave sworn testimony on 1st October 1942 and 10th February 1943, respectively. At a trial held before the Court of Division 401 at Insterburg, East Prussia, Ogorodnikov was convicted of murder on 23rd March 1943. The death sentence was confirmed on 10 June and carried out on 5th July 1943. Now, you see, all that time and trouble in order to do the right thing according to justice for this dirty captain who shot seven defenseless German prisoners of war. And they had the witnesses saying that it was so, but then they had to go through all this. And it makes a nice story as far as showing how the Germans tried to follow all the rules and the laws of a war, but it's just probably why we lost. That's my opinion. Going on, in the majority of cases, however, the investigations were discontinued or the accused acquitted for lack of evidence. So there you go. Most of them didn't come out with anything. On 27 December 1941, the Luftwaffe Court in Munster discontinued the investigation against the Russian prisoner of war, Jakow Ratin. Not only did he deny having murdered a Lieutenant Peters, but, quote, Sergeant Kownatsky, who belonged to the same unit as Lieutenant Peters and who had been seriously wounded with him, has declared that he could positively identify the murderer, but that the accused is totally unknown to him, unquote. And on 10th May 1943, the Court of Division 173 in Würzburg dismissed criminal proceedings against Colonel Alexander Tawanzu. In a deposition of 23rd June 1942, quote, Russian prisoner of war Vitaly Chegal inculpated Russian prisoner of war Colonel Tawanzu of shooting a German prisoner of war after interrogation near Jakowo in November 1941. Colonel Tawanzu, however, vigorously contested the charge, and no confrontation was possible because the whereabouts of the accuser were unknown. Quote, under these circumstances, the charge of having murdered a German prisoner of war cannot be proved, unquote. So, the final section of this chapter is titled Lists of War Criminals. The compilation of names of reported war criminals plays an important role in preparing for war crimes trial. During World War I, the Prussian Bureau of Investigation prepared two lists of alleged British and French war criminals. During World War II, the War Crimes Bureau similarly tried to discover the names of Allied war criminals and succeeded to a certain extent by taking extensive depositions of Allied prisoners of war. While American and British prisoners seldom cooperated, Polish and Russian prisoners did provide the names of many comrades who were later found to be in German prisoner of war camps. Lists of Allied war crimes and criminals were expected to prove valuable not only for judicial purposes, but also in the propaganda war. As late as 21st January 1945, Field Marshal Keitel decreed, quote, all enemy war crimes against members of the armed forces of Germany and of countries allied with Germany shall be collected retroactively since the outbreak of the war, and continuing through the future, as well as war crimes against members of the armed forces of Germany and of countries allied with Germany who are in enemy captivity and against German and other civilians. This list should include the names of enemy commanders who, according to captured documents or witness testimony, have given orders to their subordinates to commit war crimes. The armed forces shall make sure that all units down to companies and batteries are immediately informed about the importance of compiling enemy war crimes and that they be instructed to do so every 8 weeks. And henceforth, in the course of interrogating enemy prisoners of war, that the names of perpetrators and their superior officers be discovered, unquote. The collected data were to be forwarded immediately to the Department of Propaganda. It is almost certain that the Bureau, too, prepared a list for the propaganda unit, but none has been found in the existing files. And that concludes Chapter 9. I will now begin Chapter 10, which is titled Reprisals, and it is only 5 pages long. Among the more notorious crimes of the German armed forces in World War II, he starts out by talking about crimes of the German armed forces, and I just don't agree with that, but that is the position that he takes and is the general position in the world today, of course. So the chapter begins right out immediately with that phrase. He writes, among the more notorious crimes of the German armed forces in World War II was the taking of hostages from among the civilian population of occupied countries. Throughout Europe, innocent civilians were executed in reprisal for the actions of local partisans or as a means of striking terror in the population. Lidice, Orador Sur Glan, Putin, Skella, Borisovka, Shitomir are only a few of the names we remember from the International Military Tribunal at Nuremberg. It is true that reprisals were also taken by other belligerents. Now, we don't hear about those. But the German practice of executing 10 or more civilians for each German soldier killed was a clear offense against the principle of proportionality, and accordingly constituted a grave violation of international law. Although the War Crimes Bureau received detailed reports of partisan attacks, and especially of mutilations committed by Soviet partisans on German soldiers, it was not sent reports of the German reprisals that often followed. Only occasionally, when a specific reprisal plan was submitted to the Army High Command for approval, was the information supplied to the Bureau for its records. This section is headed Reprisals in Russia. In August 1941, a partisan group ambushed a German bus properly marked with the Red Cross and carrying 19 German wounded. Driver, staff, and all wounded were killed, a number of them even mutilated. The high command of the German 17th Army considered possible reprisals, including the execution of two Russian generals and all officers captured after the Battle of Podwyskogi, and proposed informing the Russians of the reprisals taken by dropping leaflets over their lines. On 12th August 1941, General K. H. von Stulpnagel rejected the plan. He wrote, "The opposite of the desired result would take place. One, according to the concurring testimony of prisoners of war in all ranks, Soviet resistance is partly the result of the soldiers' fear of being shot after capture. Announcing such a reprisal would thus confirm Russian atrocity propaganda to Russian soldiers and provide proof of those allegations. The consequences would be a hardening of their stance. Two, moreover, the efforts of German propaganda aimed at breaking their morale and at encouraging desertion by entire troop contingents under their officers would be thwarted." Unquote. Hence, the projected reprisal was never carried out. Several months later, a similar case gave rise to renewed discussion. The intelligence section of the High Command of the 17th Army reported to Army Group South on 16 January 1942, quote, "We may not expect results from reprisals. Since the beginning of the war, the Russians have been telling their soldiers that we kill Russian prisoners of war. Moreover, our taking reprisals would probably have no effect on Russian political leaders. Reprisals have a purpose only when they are openly announced. They would then provide proof of the defamatory allegations of Russian political leaders and harden the Russian will to fight. Essentially, we would ruin, through such reprisals, very important propaganda possibilities and badly blunder by not taking advantage of the disintegration of the Russian army." Unquote. In spite of these sober tactical considerations, very often reprisals were taken by the troops without checking back with higher authorities. Any discovery of mutilated corpses particularly increased the danger of indiscriminate revenge on enemy prisoners of war, though whether reprisals were indeed taken largely depended on the German officers involved. Some permitted their troops to take revenge. Others protected defenseless prisoners from being massacred. When 596 German prisoners, wounded men and female radio personnel were killed and many of them mutilated in Gneshino in February 1943, remembers one of the judges who interrogated witnesses and survivors. He said, "You have no idea how much trouble the commanders and company chiefs had to restrain the German soldiers from killing every Russian prisoner of war of the Popov Army. The troop was very bitter and angry. You cannot imagine the vehemence of the soldiers after they had seen what had happened." Unquote. The escalation of bitterness sometimes took other forms of expression. For example, there was growing hostility toward the enemy among medical orderlies and doctors who were sickened by the repeated occurrence of deliberate mutilations inflicted on wounded German soldiers. One of several such documents in the records of the War Crimes Bureau is the report of a battalion doctor to his division doctor asking for instructions. He wrote, "Please advise me how I should conduct myself in the future toward wounded Russians. After witnessing the criminal way in which the enemy has treated our wounded, I find it difficult to behave as I hitherto considered it to be my duty." Unquote. Reprisals in maritime warfare. The high command of the German Army, Navy, or Air Force, debating the pros and cons of reprisals against the enemy, frequently turned to the War Crimes Bureau for documentation. The decisive criterion, of course, remained the experience of the reprisal in the particular case. In view of numerous reports of attacks by the British Royal Navy and British Royal Air Force against defenseless German shipwrecked sailors, the German Navy seriously debated taking reprisals in September 1942 and asked the Bureau to compile a list of the 12 most significant cases. Three instances in Narvik on 10 and 13 April 1940 and nine during the Cretan campaign in May 1941. But because these cases were too old to justify a reprisal in late 1942, another instance was sought which could be used as a more immediate justification. As it happened, the German mine layer, Ulm, had been sunk by a British destroyer on 5th September 1942, and some of the survivors claimed to have been shot at in the water. When the Ulm incident came to the attention of Hitler, he wanted to take reprisals immediately, but the naval war staff objected because the general practice on the part of the Royal Navy had been to rescue German shipwrecked crews. Reported cases of shooting at men in the water represented exceptions. Moreover, further investigation of the Ulm incident failed to establish a deliberate attack. The investigation wrote, quote, "The casualties, in particular the two reported woundings, occurred while the crew members were abandoning the ship that was still afloat. The enemy bombardment evidently was directed at the ship itself and not at the crew. Since the Ulm gave no indication of surrender, the enemy was entitled to continue the bombardment. In similar cases, we ourselves would act in the same fashion. It must be considered whether reprisals would not result in greater disadvantage for us if the enemy should adopt similar measures. In this respect, it is important to note that thus far it has not been proved that the known cases of enemy attacks on German shipwrecked have been motivated or covered up by order of a British authority. Thus, we must reckon that the promulgation of a German order would be used by enemy propaganda in a way whose consequences are still very difficult to calculate." There's a roundabout way of speaking. Unquote. When the Italian hospital ship Arno was sunk by the British planes on 10 September 1942, the German naval war staff and the Italian command discussed the possibility of a coordinated policy of reprisal in the Mediterranean, but all pros and cons considered, finally decided against any retaliation. Quote, "It does not seem to us expedient to take reprisals against British hospital ships, since the enemy use of hospital ships in the Mediterranean is of minor importance, while for Italy and Germany it is imperative to transport our own wounded and sick from North Africa for reasons of both morale and supply. Moreover, quote, it has not been determined whether on the part of the British a deliberate attack on the hospital ship took place or whether the attack occurred by mistake, as was the case with the attack on the British hospital ship Somersetshire by a German submarine. If, as a result of reprisals, hospital ships on both sides lose their immunity, this is likely to be more damaging for us than for the enemy. And the final section is headed The Shackling of Prisoners. Perhaps the most notorious example of an official German reprisal concerned the shackling of prisoners of war following the British commando landing in Dieppe, France, in August 1942. As witness depositions show, numerous Germans who had been surprised by the British and who could not be immediately treated as prisoners of war were tied up for the duration of the commando action. In retaliation, Hitler ordered that all British prisoners of war in Germany should be similarly tied up. As counter-reprisal, the British government ordered German prisoners of war to be shackled. Only through the constant efforts of the International Committee of the Red Cross was this vicious circle of reprisals and counter-reprisals broken. Well, that's the end of Chapter 10. These were two very interesting chapters, I think. For my next program, I'll be reading Chapters 11 and 12, and that will bring us to the end of Part 1, after which we go into Part 2, which is about specific cases of war crimes. So even though we've learned a lot about specific cases of war crimes in this Part 1, it's going to get even more specific in Part 2. This has been Carolyn Yeager on Monday, July 20th, 2015, with Part 5 of the Wehrmacht War Crimes Bureau. See you next time.